Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Believe it or not, we don't start today with oil prices. No, the commodity du jour is that sweet yellow stuff that gets stuck in your teeth when you bite into it. Corn, in all its starchy, expensive glory. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It is the 23rd day of June. Corn's price is popping, even more so now because of the flooding of farmlands throughout the Corn Belt. Today, agribusiness giant Bunge bought a company called Corn Products International for $4.4 billion in stock. One of CPI's biggest products is high-fructose corn syrup, which the company sells to drink purveyors like Coca-Cola and food processors, including Kellogg, Unilever, and Nestle. There's a lot of concern about how healthy this sweetener is. Today, the corn syrup lobby launched a new marketing campaign. Marketplace's Jill Barchet reports.
American newspaper readers got a first glimpse of a really corny marketing campaign this morning. Full-page ads of a big yellow corn on the cob surrounded by bright green leaves. The companies that make corn syrup want to convince Americans that their sweetener is as natural as sugar or honey.
It's an uphill battle.
That's Tom Pirko, president of Bevmark. He advises big users of corn syrup like Coke and Pepsi.
We are dealing with an epidemic of obesity, and high fructose corn syrup is one of the major fattening agents in our culture.
Pirko says corn syrup producers are battling health groups and nutritionists who are demonizing the sweetener. Audrey Erickson is the president of the Corn Refiners Association. She's directing the 18-month marketing campaign that'll hit our TVs and internet screens in the next few weeks.
There will be a particular focus on magazines targeted at moms, given their important role in preparing and buying foods for their families.
American moms aren't buying corn syrup directly, but they are reading ingredient labels. And they've been buying fewer products made with corn syrup over the past year. The Wall Street Journal says the corn refiners are spending as much as $30 million to win moms over. But Bevmark's Pirko says it's not just the health concerns of American shoppers that corn syrup makers should be worried about.
They're just getting strangled by the price. The price is going up, 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 but getting higher prices on the shelf is becoming very difficult as consumers have less and less disposable income.
Pirko says as the price of corn and corn syrup rises, many food processors are looking for cheaper substitutes. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet for Marketplace.
And here's another kernel related to corn, ethanol subsidies. Both John McCain and Barack Obama say they're looking for ways to wean the U.S. off of foreign oil, but they have their differences when it comes to ethanol. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
Ethanol has been pushed front and center in this campaign because of soaring gas and corn prices. Appearing on NBC's Meet the Press back in May of 2007, Barack Obama defended his support for government subsidies for ethanol.
If we decided that we were going to make the kind of investment I've proposed, $150 billion, then I think at the end of the decade we could have an auto industry that has significantly reduced our consumption of oil.
About the same time, also on Meet the Press, John McCain explained that he's against subsidies, but he said he's changed his position on ethanol itself.
When oil is $10, $15 a barrel, that ethanol does not make sense. When oil is $60 plus a barrel, then ethanol does make sense. I still oppose the subsidies to it.
that is where the two presumptive candidates differ. Some of Obama's critics wonder why he's still supporting government subsidies for corn-based ethanol. Richard Wiles is the executive director of the Environmental Working Group.
I think it's clearly time to revisit the ethanol mandate.
Obama has said the federal government might have to rethink its support for ethanol made from corn because of skyrocketing corn prices. But the New York Times reports some of Obama's top supporters and advisors have ties to the ethanol industry. The Obama campaign says he supports ethanol on its merits. McCain, meanwhile, says we should lift tariffs on imported sugarcane and use that to make ethanol. But would any of these suggestions help voters right away? No. Joel Darmstadter of Resources for the Future says the real short-term solution isn't sexy enough. It's conservation.
I don't think that'll go over big, you know, in the electoral sweepstakes, right?
In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
By the way, John McCain today proposed a $300 million government prize to whoever can develop a new type of battery for an electric car. On Wall Street, traders took a bit of a breather today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Federal Reserve policymakers meet this week to talk interest rates. Wouldn't want to be in that room. Let's see. Is the priority inflation? Or is it propping up a slumped economy? Or do we need to rescue more banks so they start lending money again? Raise rates or keep them steady? It's all on the table. And here to parse the issues with us is Richard Cilla. He teaches economics at the New York University Stern School of Business. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
You know, the Fed is fighting all kinds of fronts here. You've got the weak economy, rising inflation at the same time with oil and food going through the roof. And then you've got banking institutions that aren't willing to lend out money to anybody anymore. This really puts the Fed between a rock and a hard place and something else, doesn't it?
Well, sure. The Fed is supposed to keep low inflation, keep a healthy economy, look after the health of the financial system. And right now, we're having slow growth. A recession hasn't been announced, but some people think we're in it. There's a lot of worries about inflation, and we know that many of our financial institutions are wounded, so nothing is going quite right as far as the Fed is concerned right now.
So what's the most important thing for the Fed to focus on as it meets this week?
The real problem that's confronting us is the health of the financial system, and there's still some major problems out there. They suffered a lot of losses, which has impaired their capital. And that means the banks, in some sense, are riskier. They don't have much of their own money in the game. They have all of our money. The Fed is encouraging them to recapitalize themselves. And one way to do that is to go and find some rich people in the world, maybe in the oil-producing countries, China, where there's a lot of surplus cash these days. And the attraction for these investors is that they get to buy the stock and the banks at lower prices than it's selling for in the market.
And we've certainly started to see that already.
Yes, that has happened already, but it may happen more as more banking institutions get into trouble. And this is going to take, I think, probably a year or two or three. That's what we saw in the early 1990s. I mean, I think the banks from their low point in 1990, they weren't really happy to lend to freely again until almost the mid-1990s. But this is why I think that although I worry about inflation, I think the real problem is to get the financial system back to health. And then the Fed can really focus on inflation.
And if it doesn't, then I presume we'll continue to see a lot of cheap lending come out of the Fed for those very banks.
Well, I think that's right. That's the way the Fed has been fighting the problem so far. It's been creating a lot of credit facilities, lending securities, increasing its purchases of government securities, trying to make the economy more liquid when there are a lot of illiquid financial assets out there that the banks not only have trouble selling to anyone, but they can't really figure out quite how valuable they are.
And would you predict also that we might see some more takeovers like that of Bear Stearns?
I think that's what one of the techniques the government uses now. When a financial institution really can't hack it, maybe because it can't raise that capital, what the Fed and the FDIC and other financial regulators do is they try to get it to be merged into or absorbed by a healthier financial institution. And I expect we're going to see quite a bit of that in the next few months.
Well, Professor Richard Silla, thank you for helping us out today.
You're welcome.
Richard Silla is a financial historian at the NYU Stern School of Business. The new GI Bill is back on the drawing boards. Democrats tucked it into the war spending bill that already passed the House. The Senate is expected to take up the measure this week. It would more than double the current education benefit given to military service members, up to $90,000. But commentator Kim Clark says the legislation has divided some of the nation's most influential veterans.
Everybody in Washington pretty much agrees on one thing. Veterans' education benefits need to be improved. The standard under the GI Bill right now is about $10,000 an academic year. Unfortunately, the total cost of attending a typical public university is more than $15,000. And private schools can cost more than three times that. No wonder fewer than a third of the first Gulf War veterans have gone on to college. They can't afford it. But for the last several months, two of the nation's most influential veterans, President Bush and Senator John McCain, have been arguing for only a modest increase in benefits, about $3,000 a year. They say anything more would be too expensive and might lure experienced soldiers away from reenlistment. They're following in some impressive political footsteps. Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Ford, all World War II veterans, also opposed efforts to increase veterans' education benefits at some point during their term. But the popularity of the GI Bill appears to be overwhelming these concerns. Congress is about to pass a compromise bill sponsored by Senator Jim Webb, who is also a decorated Vietnam veteran. It's backed by major veteran groups like the American Legion and has drawn so much bipartisan support that President Bush now says he'll sign it. It would cover full tuition and housing even at a school like UCLA, where the cost of attendance now exceeds $23,000 a year. Will this be expensive? Sure. Will it reduce reenlistments? It very well might. But the Government Accountability Office says it would increase recruitment. By opening college gates, the original GI Bill laid the foundation of the middle-class prosperity of the 50s and 60s. Research shows every dollar spent on veteran education benefits pays back at least $5 in increased taxes and economic growth. If we can't afford to give our veterans a chance at success in life, how can we afford to ask our soldiers to brave death?
Kim Clark covers money for U.S. News and World Report. Send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. Coming up, putting the pressure on Zimbabwe's president.
A lot of average Zimbabweans only know that sanctions exist against the country. They don't know that they're actually targeted at President Robert Mugabe and his senior elite.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street treaded water today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average barely budged. It gave up a fraction of a point to close at 11,842. The NASDAQ lost 20 points, 0.8% to finish at 2385. And the S&P was basically flat, closing at 1318. Oil prices rose despite Saudi Arabia's pledge to raise output. That lifted energy shares. Exxon pumped up 3.3%. Chevron rose 2.5%. But that same oil news sent airline stocks into a double-digit drop. Delta lost 12%. Shares in Continental plunged 16%. United was down 15%. Financial stocks also felt the pain after Bank of America cut second quarter earnings estimates for brokerages. Merrill Lynch and Citigroup each lost nearly 4%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.17. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. In New York, the Conference Board releases its latest Consumer Confidence Index. The Federal Open Market Committee meets to discuss interest rates. And the House Ways and Means Committee holds a hearing on protecting Social Security beneficiaries from predatory lending practices. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. If you're hearing us in California, put down your phone and listen up. As of July 1st, you can no longer hold your cell phone and drive at the same time. The land of the car crazed is finally joining the long list of states with hands-free cell phone laws. And as KQED's Rob Schmitz reports, that's giving the headset trade something to talk about.
California Highway Patrol officer Miguel Luivano has seen it all on L.A.'s freeways.
Everything from people eating, applying makeup, shaving, even having sex in the car while driving.
In comparison, holding a cell phone to your ear may seem tame. But under a new law, California residents who drive and dial could be fined up to $76. With 23 million drivers, that could mean a lot of dough for state coffers. In the first 3 years of New York's hands-free law, the state pulled in around $27 million in fines.
Say a command.
Call office.
Did you say call office?
Yes.
Calling.
Lee DiOrlando tests the clarity of a Bluetooth speaker that attaches to your car's visor. He sells them at eWireless Communications in Los Angeles.
Good morning. Thank you for calling eWireless.
Yeah, doing a phone check, Eddie.
Okay, Lee, I hear you loud and clear.
Thank you.
DiOrlando says he's working overtime to keep up with customer demand.
In the past month, I'd say our hands-free and Bluetooth equipment has probably quadrupled.
It's the same story for Santa Cruz-based Plantronics, one of the nation's top headset manufacturers, says spokesman Dan Race.
The sales trend is upticking right now, and we think will continue throughout July.
Race says consumers are waiting until the last minute to buy the devices. Some people are ordering them for free from websites like freeheadset.org. But not June Millam. He's in downtown L.A. shopping for a new phone that he plans to hold brazenly to his ear while driving.
I remember I've swerved probably into the lanes, but I've always gotten back into my lane. I think it's so dangerous. It doesn't matter to me. I'm still talking on the phone.
Millam says most of the time he isn't a danger to anyone. That's because he's crawling along in L.A. traffic. In Los Angeles, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
You may not be able to hold the phone while you're driving, but at least for the rest of this year, you might get better mileage reimbursement. The Internal Revenue Service says because of the hike in gas prices, it's raising the reimbursement rate by 8 cents a mile for the last 6 months of this year. Those high gas prices are a major reason for what some are calling the demise of the SUV. For the next 9 weeks, Ford is shutting down a factory that makes large SUVs. The company can't afford to produce more Expeditions and Navigators when it's already sitting on massive unsold inventories. General Motors is also closing factories producing pickups and SUVs. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more.
Pickup trucks and SUVs had been cash cows for American carmakers. Not anymore.
The fuel crisis that we're in is a disaster for the domestic car makers. This is altering their production and profit picture very, very significantly.
That's Jack Nerad, executive editorial director at Kelley Blue Book. He expects manufacturers will be forced to offer deep discounts or special financing to motivate folks who've begun to look at the gas guzzlers as money pits. It's a radical shift in consumer demand. Lee Fishbein is president of Worldwide Auto Brokers. He works with the Range Rover dealership near Aspen, Colorado. A year ago, he says their SUVs were so hot they didn't last on the lot.
Now they're, I would say, bursting at the seams with inventory. Their business from last year, same period, is down approximately 70%.
Consumers who own SUVs are also finding it hard to unload them. Jack Nerad says the used market is equally depressing.
We've seen their depreciation virtually double over the course of the last 8 to 10 months. It's been a very rapid decline in these vehicles.
SUV resale prices are starting to sound like fire sale prices.
You see them going through the auctions for like 30%, 40% below their market value.
That's Abe Bajeripour, an auto broker with Trade-In Solutions. We spoke while sitting in the company's Dodge Caravan. Bajeripour says some dealers have stopped taking such fuel-hungry 6-cylinder and 8-cylinder vehicles.
I've actually had people that went into dealers that they purchased their car from originally. When they went back to sell it to them, they try anything just to get out of buying it back from them.
Bajeripour sells some secondhand SUVs abroad. Hummers are still popular in Russia, where the weak dollar makes them look like a bargain. Broker Lee Fishbein has been trying his luck at auto arbitrage.
I bought an 06 Hummer. You know, that car sold for $60,000 brand new. It had 8,000 miles on it, and I was the highest bid in the city of Denver at $25,000.
Fishbein managed to sell it for a small profit, but many dealers haven't been so lucky.
My honest feeling is there's going to be some sort of attrition as far as dealers go. I think you're going to see some of them go out of business. You're going to see some consolidate.
These tough times can work to a consumer's advantage. Rental car companies, for example, have large fleets of SUVs. Because they're unpopular, SUVs are being rented at a big discount. Kelley Blue Book's Jack Nerad recently shaved $100 off his car rental bill.
When I took the discount for taking a minivan, it was a significant saving and more than paid for any amount of gasoline that I would purchase.
It's a good deal if you're not driving far, but some consumers complain of never being given an option. At the rental car counter, they find their reservation for an economy-sized car has been upgraded to an SUV. Let's just say it's not generally a pleasant surprise. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
And here's one more way to get SUVs off the lot. Offer 0% financing. Reuters reports GM is doing just that. No interest for 6 years on all pickup trucks and SUVs, starting tomorrow and through the end of the month. Zimbabwe's opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai has dropped out of the country's presidential runoff election. It's scheduled to take place on Friday. Tsvangirai fled to the Dutch embassy in Harare yesterday as police descended on his party's headquarters. The government says it will go ahead with Friday's balloting, despite calls from UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon for a postponement. There is also now renewed discussion of economic sanctions against President Robert Mugabe's regime. Joining us now from South Africa is reporter Gretchen Wilson. Welcome.
Hi, Tess.
So how can the UN, the African Union, Western countries try to apply some pressure on Mugabe?
You know, Tess, I keep thinking about Hamlet when he said, words, words, words. Words are one way that countries are trying to exert pressure on from the sidelines. Today, France's foreign minister said the election in Zimbabwe without the opposition candidate would be, quote, the biggest denial of democracy that Africa has ever known. But, of course, words can only go so far, as you know. So economic sanctions are one of the other ways to isolate President Robert Mugabe and his 28-year-old regime. The African Union and Southern African Development Community, that's a regional bloc here in Southern Africa, are now seeking to figure out what to do. And economic sanctions may be part of that package. So far, they haven't exerted any economic sanctions on the country, whereas the United States, the European Union, and Australia have put into place a series of economic sanctions that target Mugabe and his senior officials.
Well, Gretchen, have economic sanctions worked in the past?
Not really. EU sanctions really have put a travel ban on Mugabe and more than 100 of his senior officials, but they haven't really worked because there's a lot of loopholes. So most of the sanctions include regional arms embargoes, travel and study restrictions, and seizing or freezing the personal assets of a lot of Zimbabwean senior officials. And these really haven't done much because the sanctions have actually reinforced President Robert Mugabe's rhetoric around what he calls illegal sanctions at political rallies and state media. He oftentimes refers to the fact that these illegal sanctions are the reason why the economic situation in the country has plummeted in recent years. So a lot of average Zimbabweans only know that sanctions exist against the country. They don't know that they're actually targeted at President Robert Mugabe and his senior elite.
Then what would make them work now?
Well, anything that's put into place by the United States or the European Union or the West or the United Nations really has to be backed up by Zimbabwe's neighbors in Africa. Up until now, other African countries, as I said, haven't exerted economic sanctions on the country. And in fact, many of Zimbabwe's neighbors have actually been subsidizing the country through its economic downfall. These countries supply the Zimbabwe with electricity, with basic goods and services, because ideologically they see that the country's been isolated from the West and they want to support the people of Zimbabwe. And that's always the issue with sanctions. How do you exert pressure on a particular regime and try to change that regime without affecting the average people on the ground?
Then what do you think we can expect as we move forward in this situation?
Well, I think over the next couple of days, we're going to have a real wait-and-see approach because the fact of the matter is there's a diplomatic storm that's been created in this last few days. Today, there was a raid on the opposition party's headquarters, and 39 people or more were taken away by police in riot gear. This is really kind of points to the fact that this crackdown on opposition supporters doesn't show any signs of letting up, even though the election has been called off for the moment.
Reporter Gretchen Wilson joining us from Johannesburg. Thank you, Gretchen.
Thank you, Tess.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, a bit of workplace history being made today, that workplace being the Pentagon. After 33 years of service, Lieutenant General Ann Dunwoody is getting a promotion to four-star general. She is the first woman to garner all that hardware. Dunwoody will head up the Army's Material Command, which handles every single piece of equipment, uniforms, and armor for that service branch. Women traditionally have not been able to rise to the rank of four-star general because they're not allowed to serve in combat roles. The Army decided to let her be all that she can be anyway. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow was flat, dropping a fraction of a point. The Nasdaq shed 20 points, 0.8%, and the S&P traded flat to close at 1318. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time, helping out the neighborhood business.
It pays for an awning on a bodega, an additional machine in a bakery. Sometimes it provides the funding for an individual attorney who wants to start up his or her own practice.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.